conversations on life, style, beauty, and relationships. It's the Velvet's Edge podcast with Kelly Henderson.
Okay, Katie Gustafson. We just went through a pronunciation experiment with your last name. Did I get it?
Yes. It's like the first couple of times, I feel like you have to kind of say it slow.
Yeah.
Until you kind of come to get used to it. But it's just, there's too many consonants. It's Gustafson.
Gustafson. It's the combination of the S, F and the S for me.
Yes.
We got it. I feel like we got it.
We got it.
No. So we were just talking. I can't believe I've never met you. You're in Nashville, but you are a psychotherapist who also specializes in the Enneagram, which are honestly two of my favorite things in the world.
That's so cool. I love that.
I want to know how you got into therapy. Why did you decide to become a therapist?
To sort out my own head.
Yeah, I hear that.
No, it's really interesting. So I knew about the Enneagram before I became a therapist.
Okay.
So they kind of went hand in hand for me always. I have been in therapy from a young age. I have struggled a lot with chronic depression and anxiety also from a young age. And so I just, you know, the two things that really helped me to kind of make sense of my world was being in therapy pretty early on and then coming to find the Enneagram about 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. And so I was actually in the music world and did singer-songwriter stuff as I was going to grad school to become a therapist. Wow. And it was always kind of like my plan B, and it just became such a love for me, just therapy. It was just this world that I felt seen and known in. Mm. And so I went kind of full force into building a practice after I graduated from grad school, and have just been doing that ever since and have loved it. And it just gives so much meaning to so much of my story with depression and anxiety. I mean, of course, now knowing how to work with those things, it's been so fulfilling to just support people on that process as well.
Yeah, I love that you just said it's given meaning to it for me in my life, therapy and in some of just the inner work that I've done, putting a name to the things I was feeling and, you know, kind of bouncing around in my head, even the crazy stuff. Helps. It just is so relieving, right? Like when you can actually just put the name to something, you can go, oh, I'm not crazy. There's right. a reason I feel like this.
Absolutely.
And it all seems to make sense.
Right. Totally. And that, I think that too, with the Enneagram, you know, we'll get into this in a little bit, but it's just the Enneagram really gives us a roadmap, and it helps us understand the story that we've been living out of.
Right.
It helps us understand, because I believe our personality is kind of the story that we've been living out of from a young age. And so, so the Enneagram, finding that, just unlocked a new layer of truth for me.
Yeah.
In terms of who I was created to be, and how I had played really small. And so it was this really beautiful kind of self-discovery and just this incredibly effective language that I could now speak, you know,
yeah.
knowing my type and knowing all of the inner workings of that.
Ugh, I love that. I was reading in your bio, and I actually, your bio resonated so much with me, because you say, it says in private practice, you specializes in women's individual therapy and is passionate about holding a safe space for those who long for healing and transformation. And I get so much joy, peace. It feels like this is how life should be when I'm holding space for people who actually want to heal and transform. I love that feeling. Why does that feel so good to you, do you think?
Well, I think my Enneagram, my dominant type is 4. I'm a dominant type.
Me too.
You are? Oh my gosh. Of course you are.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, not that other types don't hold beautiful space for those that are hurting, but I think those interior tunnels that seem really dark to a lot of people mm-hmm. seem very familiar to me. So it's kind of the water I swim in.
Yeah.
And so getting to hold space for someone to go into those darker emotions, often for the first time, feels like something I was made to do.
Yeah.
And it's probably something that you do really well with your clients as well.
Yeah.
And with this podcast, you know, it takes a lot to shock a type 4, I think.
Well, that's what I was just thinking when you were talking. I do not feel uncomfortable at all in the dark places with people.
Right.
And what's so interesting is like when you say, for those who long for healing and transformation, like it's odd to me that some people don't long for that. Like I can't comprehend that because I long so deeply to look at what happened and understand why it was bad, not stay there, but understand it so that I can transform it and heal from it. And I'm not bringing it into the rest of my life. And I think because I've experienced the positive aspects of that, I want that for everybody. You know, I'm like, come on, let's go. But you have to want it, which is such an interesting part of therapy, of this Enneagram work, of all of it.
Totally. Yeah. Having that desire, I often say that, you know, our desire is the most valuable asset that we have, you know, and to be in alignment and in integrity with our desires really is our growth path. It really is our roadmap home. You know, it's our homecoming.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it fuels everything.
Yeah.
So yeah, I love that you resonate with that need to really long for healing in a deep and passionate way.
Yeah. Well, again, like you said, I think that's a type 4 thing. So let's dive into the Enneagram because you really do use it. I mean, again, in your bio, it says that you have several modalities that you use, but including the Enneagram a lot to unblock past trauma, to reconcile broken narratives that no longer fit, and to write a compelling new chapter. So I think most of my listeners probably are familiar with the Enneagram. I've had Sarah Jane Case on from Enneagram and Coffee.
Oh, she's so fabulous.
She's amazing. And then I think a lot of the people who listen to this podcast are just seekers as well. And so they probably know, but just in case there's some people who have never heard of the Enneagram, can you give us like a brief description of what the Enneagram actually is?
Yes. And I want to tee that up.
Okay.
Just really quickly, Kelly, and talk about what personality is.
Okay.
Because did Sarah Jane talk about personality specifically or just?
No, she actually didn't. And what's so interesting that you say that is I was just listening to an Oprah podcast, like right before I got on the phone with you. And they were talking about personality and soul and how the connection between those two. And I have never put those two together, but I would love to hear your description of that.
I think you'll get a kick out of it. It's really helpful for me to understand personality before I understand how the Enneagram is powerful.
Okay, great.
So basically, human beings, as you well know, are wired for survival, you know?
Yeah.
And by adapting to the expectations and demands of our culture and our circumstances, we become expert survivors in life. So like you and I are walking around in our little 4 type and we have become expert survivors within our personality. And so one of the most effective tools for survival is personality.
Okay.
And the word personality is derived from the Greek word persona, which means mask. And so that is so powerful to me because it demonstrates just how much we actually wear our mask of personality around to protect us from harm, mm-hmm. to protect us from possible rejection, right? And we do this, we gravitate towards personality in early childhood to, you know, fit in with our friends and our peers, to please our parents and our teachers and our coaches, right? And we do this very strategically, but very unconsciously. So our personalities are made up of this constellation of innate qualities, coping strategies, defense mechanisms, affects and reflexes, and they are all designed to protect us from possible harm in life, especially in childhood. And so what happens is over time, this, again, this unique personality that the Enneagram teaches, there are 9 core personalities, but this personality becomes the story that we live out of, so much so that like when you come into contact with people, they come to expect your personality, right? Because they experience that as who you are.
Right.
And so as we mature and become adults, life gets much more complex. Life definitely throws us curveballs. And the personality that we innocently gravitated to in our early childhood is no longer needed in the same way. Now that we're adults, we don't need our personality in the same way. However, our personality doesn't just disappear. Our personality has to expand and adjust in order to meet these new complexities that we have in adulthood. Are you tracking? Is this making sense?
It is making sense. Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, especially the survival piece of the personality, because I know that just from therapy, it's like we develop all these survival skills as children. And if we keep carrying a lot of them into our adulthood, they actually become dysfunctional within our relationships and they don't work anymore. Right. Cause we're not
really,
we are adults. We don't need someone else to take care of us as far as feeding us with a roof over it. Like this is now our responsibility that we can cover. So these survival tools can also really affect a relationship in a bad way, in a negative way.
Absolutely. Because what happens is we now have these overgrown personalities in adulthood and we've lost touch with that true, authentic, essential self that we were born into the world, right? Like you were born into the world, this loving, curious, whole being, right? We learn fear. We don't come in as fearful, right? We have to learn that. And so as we become adults, we're walking around with these often really overgrown personalities and we start bumping into stuff. And that's when we kind of wake up and have this existential questioning inquiry of like, who the hell am I?
Yeah.
I don't even know myself anymore because I've become so removed from the authentic self, the essential self, right? And so that's typically when I get a phone call and somebody needs to jump into therapy and kind of deconstruct this personality to really get back to the truth of who they are.
Yeah.
And so you're right, at the core of all of our people problems is personality. And so in order to work on, and I believe the number one indicator for success in life and relationships is self-awareness. And so the Enneagram is just the best tool we have to understand the truth of who we are. I've heard it said that the Enneagram helps us know who we were before the world told us who we needed to be.
Oh, I love that.
It's like, it's so powerful because it goes deeper. It goes so much deeper than just our personality traits. It goes to the core belief systems that we've been living out of. It unearths the motivations for why we think, feel, and act the way that we do in our personality. And so it's not wanting to just box us in to a personality type, right? It's wanting us to see the box of personality that we're in so that we can get out of that box and live into That's my 18-month-old. He's not napping today. So
oh, no.
for the ambient freak out. So yes, anyway, that's what I love about the Enneagram compared to some other personality tests like Myers-Briggs, StrengthsFinder, and DISC, which are all awesome tools.
Yeah, they're, I love those so too. Helpful. Yeah.
They don't quite go as deep as the Enneagram in that they don't really unpack kind of the why behind how we show up in the world.
Right. Can you kind of do a little rundown of the 9 types so that if anyone listening doesn't know their type, maybe
yes, totally
get started in that kind of that discovery for themselves?
Yes. So like we said earlier, and like many of you know, the Enneagram teaches that there's 9 core types of personality.
Okay.
One of which we gravitated to in early childhood. So you gravitated to this type 4, so did I. And so we'll start with type 8.
Okay.
And we'll just do a little flyby of all 9.
Why do you start with type 8? Just out of curiosity.
I start with type 8 because type 8s, 9s, and 1s are housed in what's called the body center or triad. And I believe that as we develop, before we're even born, the first thing to develop is our actual gut center.
Okay.
Our body forms. And so that I think it's important in a like developmentally to go in order. Or that's just my OCD preference, but you know, I think it's just a powerful way to teach the Enneagram to start with the body center.
Okay.
You know, something that we're all housed in. This body center houses the whole of who we are, then to move into the heart center and then to finish up with the head center. The reason I don't start with 7 is because 7s would just peace out after.
Right.
They're not going to stick around for the whole gamut of type. So we just start with type 8 so that they'll hang around till the end to get to their type.
I love that. I have the most difficult time in my life when I look at all the relationships that are tough for me. They're all type 8s. So I thought I was like, when you said that, I was like, oh, shots fired. How did you know this about me?
That's hilarious.
Yeah. Oh,
man. No, I'm curious about that for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
So type 8 is known sometimes as the challenger, sometimes as the protector. 8s value justice and honesty, and they thrive off of intensity in life. They're very self-assured, decisive, and willful, and they bring this big energy into the room wherever they go. They make amazing leaders who tirelessly fight for their people, right? Especially the marginalized. They really are justice seekers and truth tellers. 8s fear being controlled or betrayed. And so ironically, this leads them to becoming controlling themselves, right? Because mm-hmm. they're so fearful of being controlled. So they can tend to be pretty aggressive. They can come off as pretty aggressive and often controlling.
Can I ask a question really fast?
Yeah.
So when you said that their greatest fear is being controlled or the betrayal piece, could an 8 get hypervigilant about being betrayed because of that fear? Like,
oh, sure.
I think that's one of the things that I've bumped up against the control.
Yeah.
It's interesting to hear that as the deep-rooted fear. I didn't understand that. Okay.
Yeah.
Keep going.
No, that definitely checks out for the 8.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, and so in order to maintain this strong kind of exterior, they armor up, right? And they hide the softest, most vulnerable parts of themselves, which they do have, by the way.
Right, right.
However, it's just, you know, it was never safe early on for them to show those parts. So they learned how to hide those parts. And so that's why they come across oftentimes as very kind of gruff and very forthcoming. They mm-hmm. are straight shooters. Their core belief is that you must be strong and powerful to assure protection and regard in the world and to be wow. valuable in the world. So you wow. could see how that could be really problematic moving through relationships.
I've dealt with it a lot. Yes.
I get it. I totally get it. The peacemaker has a nine. The type nine. Type yeah. nine.
Okay.
Type nine, the peacemaker, often called the mediator, quite a different energy sometimes. Nines value a calm and peaceful environment. And they will do whatever they can to keep it that way. They're super easygoing, really agreeable and self-effacing. They're just go with the flow people. And so much so that in seeking harmony, they often kind of merge with other people. Mm. That word merge is really important for type nines to be aware of. And in that, developing, you know, adequate boundaries in relationships becomes a lot of the work for type nines. But they can often become super self-forgetting because they're so focused on your needs.
Right.
And keeping the peace. So they're super conflict avoidant and sometimes really stubborn. I'm married to a type nine and can tend to just really sit in that stubbornness.
That's interesting. So they're conflict, they have a conflict aversion, but they're also stubborn.
Yes. It's part of their way. Kind of the stubbornness is kind of part of their passive aggression.
Okay.
A lot of nines can be experienced as passive aggressive, and it's a very subtle stubbornness.
Okay.
And so you often don't really see it on the front end, but yes, this stubbornness is, anger is the dominant emotion for the body or gut triad. And we won't get into that really, but that's really all you need to know is that their relationship is very, for eights, nines, and ones, there's a very specific relationship with this core emotion of anger.
That makes
and
sense.
So for a nine, that often looks as passive aggressiveness.
Okay.
And that stubbornness is how they show up in passive aggression.
Okay.
And they can, you know, there's this, the myth, the belief, the misguided belief really is that they're lazy. Nines are lazy. Nines are some of the most active people on the Enneagram. Where the laziness and inertia come in is as it pertains to their self-development, as it pertains to their finding and using their voice, right? Yeah. So that becomes the work of type nines, really, is to know that their voice is so valuable and their presence is so valuable. So the core belief here is that to be loved and valued, you must blend in and kind of go along to get along. So that is the invitation for type nines, is to really connect to their voice.
Okay.
Connect to the importance of their presence in the world. Type ones, often known as the perfectionist, often I like to call type ones the reformers, because a lot of ones I know do not identify with this title of the perfectionist. So type ones look around them and see things not just as they are, but as they could be. So they are constantly looking to improve the world around them, to reform the world around them. They're conscientious, highly responsible, self-controlled, but they can really be highly critical, both of themselves and other people, often reading as resentful and, again, very self-critical. They have rigidly held belief systems and standards, and that can oftentimes cause them a lot of frustration, because these impossible expectations just cannot be met realistically. Mm-hmm. So the core belief for type one is that in order to be good, in order to be worthy, you must be seen as good and right. So mm-hmm. there's this there is this constant just treadmill of strife and you know, impossible standards that they're trying to meet for themselves. Now, if I were ever to have brain surgery, you better believe I would want that surgeon to be a type one. They are just completely detail oriented and just live out of such excellence. So, you know, there are, as with every type, there are, you know, it's like the blessing is the flip side of the coin that the curse, you know, as well.
They're two sides of that. So do type ones, my boyfriend's a type one, and which is a very interesting dynamic between a four and a one. And we can talk about that once we talk about a four, but like, do ones have a hard time accepting their humanity, like their humanness?
Totally.
Because like kind of what we were talking about with a four, we're okay getting in the muck and the mud, but a one, because they're constantly striving to be good. And what was the other word you said?
Right.
Good and right. That doesn't sound like a human being to me. So like, would they bump up against a lot of shame? Maybe. Absolutely. For imperfection. Okay. Interesting.
Absolutely. That is the work that I do with type ones in coaching and in therapy. Is it's all about self-compassion.
Yeah.
Developing a self-compassion practice. And really part of self-compassion is understanding that humanity is flawed.
Right.
You know, our common thread as humans is our fragility. And for a one to really get into contact with that flawed nature of humanity is so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And that surrender, right?
Yes. But that seems like it would take a lot of work for that mentality. That would be very hard for them.
It is. I mean, I often think that ones have the hardest time, you know, just because of that violent inner critic.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That keeps them just kind of cramped. I love what Anne Lamott says, that like she says, perfectionism is the voice of the oppressor. It will keep us cramped and insane our whole lives.
I love Anne Lamott.
Don't you love her?
So good.
I think, I'm not sure what type she is, but I would imagine she's a type four.
All our people. Okay, let's get to a two. What is a two?
Okay, so type two. Now we're moving into the heart triad.
Okay.
So these twos, threes, and fours really kind of experience the world more through this emotional capacity. Twos, often known as the helper, often known as the befriender. I kind of love that term for them. Twos are motivated by relationships, right? They're just the most relational people on the Enneagram. They are caring, helpful, but can also be prideful, surprisingly, to a lot of people, and overly intrusive and demanding.
Mm-hmm.
Twos can often feel taken for granted for in relationships because they find themselves giving so much more than they receive, right? Their number one survival strategy is connection with people in relationship. So the fear for the type two is being useless to others, being dispensable to others. Mm-hmm. So the core belief for type twos is that you must give fully to others to be loved, to be seen as worthy. Type threes, the achiever. Type threes are there. They pay attention to whatever it takes to be seen as successful in life. So they're driven by success and accomplishment. They're diligent, productive, busy, very goal-oriented, and generally achieve what they set out to achieve in life, right? Yeah. And they look good doing it. It's so annoying. Right? Like there's probably a lot of three, you probably work with a lot of threes in your world.
A ton of threes in my world.
Definitely. You know, and they're so good. They're, you know, in their healthiest selves, they're incredible role models.
Right.
And incredible leaders in culture and politics. And they're strategizing and accomplishing, though. They tend to take on this shape-shifting kind of chameleon-like behavior in order to prove themselves valuable to other people around them. So they are the most image-conscious people on the Enneagram. And that doesn't just mean they're vain. It means that they are the most concerned about what you think of them.
Okay.
Because they're again driven by the need to be seen as successful in the world.
But we would never recognize how driven they are for our validation, right? Like a three would cover that up and it would be very subtle.
Say more about that.
Like the threes that I know, I would never even think that they cared if I approved of anything they were doing or whatever. But now that I'm learning more about this and kind of I've been digging into this with some of my friends who are threes.
Yeah.
And they're like, yes, like, but they don't show that in the same way. Like it doesn't present itself in this way of like, I need to know that you approve of me or whatever.
Absolutely. No, okay. That's spot on because they're so very task oriented,
yeah,
very goal oriented, and the overlay is confidence. So,
right.
You know, they are just incredibly, you know, disarming because you just see them as so confident mm-hmm. and so accomplished. How could they ever, you know, have this deep, deep, deep insecurity?
Right.
I always talk about, this is fascinating to me. I don't know how old you are. You're probably much younger than me, but
I'm 39.
Do you remember a tennis player named Andre Agassi?
Oh yeah. I'm almost 39. So okay. I'm not that, I don't think I'm that as young as you think.
So he wrote an autobiography.
Yeah.
And he talked about how he became a tennis star to garner the to be loved by his father. Essentially, he hated tennis. He hated what? Every minute of it. Yeah, he talks about this in his book of just wow. about how he was so desperate for his dad's approval, and that was the impetus for him becoming this just larger than life tennis star.
Do you think he's a type three?
I would definitely think he would be a type three. I mean, I don't know him, so that's not fair of me to say. It's kind of the cardinal sin of the Enneagram. I don't know, but you know, even if he's not a three, that's very three-ish behavior.
Right. You know? Right.
And to your point, we would never know it. We would never did not love tennis.
No,
we would never know that core of insecurity existed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Their driving belief, this core belief that you must accomplish and succeed to be loved.
Yeah. So
clearly very problematic until they learn and come into this beautiful space that says that they're human beings, not human doings, mm-hmm. right? And they can really embrace themselves as such, mm-hmm. which is a journey. It's wow. such a process.
Yeah.
So right. Type four, moving right along. Mm-hmm. We got this one covered. So, you know, they can be called the individualist, the romantic, the idealist. I always tell people, don't get hung up on the name, you know, okay. just if you don't resonate with the name of the type, just go by the number, you know, because they okay. can often be misleading. So type fours have this rich interior life, as we have talked about, and they relish this kind of range of emotions. It's, you know, it's their, like I said, it's the water they swim in, and they long to be unique, to be seen as special. They're creative, very artistic, often, not always. Self-expression is everything to a type four. They value empathy and authenticity, and can also be pretty moody, right?
Very I'm dying laughing because you're just describing me right now.
Yeah. I mean, I'm, the reason I know this is because I've lived it, right? Just right. Like you have. They're just super expressive with their wide range of emotions. They have this emotional literacy that is, again, their blessing and their curse. Mm-hmm.
Why do you say curse? Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. Well, I think the trap in that is to become so kind of self-focused and to really lose touch with the fact that they are not, we're not our emotions. Mm-hmm. I am not my emotions. You are not your emotions. You are Kelly. I am Katie. You know, again, I'm a human being. And I think fours can tend to really indulge. We can tend to really indulge this darker kind of side of our emotional life. And if we're not careful, this unconscious behavior can take over, this autopilot, and our emotions can drive us around all day long, you yeah. know, in the driver's seat. And so, you know, it's so what the work I do with fours is to externalize their emotional experience and to really separate out this to develop some healthy detachment from the emotional experience.
Okay.
Because it can be so overwhelming. And that's why, I mean, I think a lot of fours, you know, we do kind of tend to gravitate towards depression and those kind of darker spaces. And so again, learning how to manage our emotional experience is so, so important.
Yeah.
In the inner work that we do. Would you say that's true for you?
Yes. I mean, I would say probably one of my boyfriend's biggest complaints about my personality would be that I focus too much on the negative.
Yeah.
Like I can get stuck there. And he is very clear with me about that. Like, I feel like we're in this loop of worry and, you know, the dark sides of stuff. It's been kind of good for me to have someone who points that out to me, because I don't think I'm so comfortable there. I don't know that I realize that I'm, you know, on a loop of stuff. But isn't it true that people typically, like, you don't want to be the number that you are? Because, like, that makes me cringe to hear you say the stuff about the negativity, the moodiness. Like, I'm like, I don't want to be that person like that. But I know it's true at the same time, you know?
Totally. I mean, that's been my experience. And it also has for a lot of people that I know. I think we're so acquainted with our weaknesses, so much so
yeah.
that it's easier for us to identify our personality type based on our weaknesses, not our strengths.
Yeah.
You know, we have this negative bias as human beings, and we're just very, you know, I've heard, you know, it's like the saying, we're Teflon for the positive and Velcro for the negative.
So true. So true.
So you're right. Yeah. We kind of get grossed out by when we come into contact with our type, and it's like, oh man, that just pegged me and yeah, pegged all the darker parts of me that I tried to hide from people.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. And that you don't want to really have to admit to yourself, if I'm being completely honest. Like, I don't want to, I've, you know, had this issue with being told I'm too much. That's like a very sensitive yeah. thing for me. But when I hear the type four description, I'm like, I could see maybe where some other numbers that would overwhelm them.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. And it's, you know, the beauty and the invitation of the Enneagram is that there's a growth path for every right. type. And so, you know, the more work we do with the Enneagram, the less prominent our type tendencies become, because
oh, interesting.
We kind of soften around the edges, right?
Yeah.
And we become less in our personality, less in our ego, and more in this kind of open, receptive, true, authentic self.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty. It's like, that's what we're going for, to get out of that box of personality and then open up to this beautiful, almost spiritual experience of receptivity mm-hmm. and allowance and curiosity. So yeah, that's where we're all headed. And that's the common denominator here.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense to me. Cause honestly, when, going back to the example of like staying on the loop of the negative, when he used to say that to me, it would make me so mad, you know, and I was just so, resistant to that. Like, no, I'm not. No, what? But then I sat with myself because I did start investigating a little more about the four demeanor. And once I could accept it within myself, it's so interesting because now if he points it out, I'm like, oh, am I doing that again? Like, yeah. And I can kind of ask myself if I feel like I'm stuck and then take some steps to maybe focus on things I have to be grateful for. Like, I have new tools that I can do, but it took me accepting that maybe that is a characteristic of my personality. And like, it doesn't have to be good or bad. It just is.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, that's beautiful. That's it. There's so much. It's like, there's so much acceptance. There's so much room to explore acceptance. Enneagram. That's just what I love about it so much. But yeah, that tendency that we have as fours to kind of see what's missing and to see how, the work that you do, fours have this incredible capacity for aesthetic. And like so many fours, we really relish in this knowing what fits, knowing what looks good, knowing what's the good stuff in life, you know? So the work that you do as a stylist is so perfect. Like, to be a four in the line of work that you do is so, you know, you can't make the stuff up, right? Like, right. It's just, you have this innate, you lead with this incredible ability to put things together and to make things beautiful. And the curse of that too is that, you know, there's this way that it should be, like this ideal way. And so if it's not that way, like we're always seeing like, this could be so much better if I was, if the lighting was right here. And if it was black and white and, if it were at 5 o'clock instead of 10 o'clock in the morning,
it's so true.
It's just, and again, it's the blessing and the curse, right?
Well, there's the two parts of that I totally resonate with are that one, people constantly email me and say, how did you get in this business? Were you trained? Were you this? Like, what do you look at style-wise to learn what to put people in? And I'm like, I don't. Like, I literally go pick out clothes and I just see it. I don't know how to describe it. I see it in my head, what would work together, what the look should be. Like, I just see it.
Yes.
But then on the flip side, what you're describing about if it was just this different or it has to be a certain way, like I am never satisfied with my work completely, ever.
Right.
Exhausting. I can barely even post about the stuff that I do because it'll be that one thing that just, it kills me that I can't even, and then I can't even appreciate the whole picture. So I'm like, I'm done. You know?
Oh, I know.
It's torture.
It's so hard. I resonate with that totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Okay. Let's move on to a five because I think we could probably talk about fours forever. Yeah. Maybe I need to book a session.
So funny. Or we could just go get a cocktail.
Yeah, that works too.
Type fives, the observer. Often called the investigator. Fives focus on information and mastery of diverse subjects, right?
They're
perpetual learners and they tend towards privacy and introversion. They tend to observe their inner world rather than really engage with it. So they can often seem aloof or detached. They value self-sufficiency so much and are more comfortable with alone time than any other number. Solitude is very important to type fives. They, in an effort to remain self-sufficient and preserve their resources, they lean towards this thing called avarice, which is greed, basically. So they kind of like hoover up all of their emotional resources, material resources even. And that's all being fueled by this need to be self-sufficient, right? They can be withholding emotionally and materially even from others. So their core belief is that you must protect yourself from this world that demands too much and gives too little, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that is their survival strategy on planet Earth, is self-efficiency and kind of this reservoir of their internal resources, material resources. And in some ways they can seem a little bit stingy, but this is their unconscious survival strategy. So they come by it honestly. You know, their work is to really open up and learn to engage, right, with their emotional world a little bit more, to get into their bodies a little bit more.
Yeah.
And just to drop out of that headspace that they elevate as most important.
Okay. Okay.
So type five, fascinating.
Yeah. I know one type five, and he does get very in his head. He can't really he overanalyzes everything, but, everything that has been my experience. And I just look at it sometimes, I'm like, gosh, that must be exhausting.
Totally.
So I guess they have to find the balance between the analytical piece of what is great about their personality and then going extreme with it. Would that be?
Right.
Yeah.
Totally. Okay. It's this, kind of, again, this healthy detachment.
Yeah.
That becomes the work of the type five, you know? But yes, analyzing, and overanalyzing, that's the water they swim in. That's their natural habitat, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's talk about a six.
Okay. Sixes, the loyalist. Sixes, you know, the core belief for type six, you must gain certainty and security, right? In a hazardous world that you can't trust. So they're all about getting, acquiring security, safety and security. That is their core need in life, is to be safe and secure, quite simply. They are trustworthy, they're inquisitive, they're committed people. Sixes are often the rocks in our friendships and relationships. Sometimes it might be hard to gain the trust of a six, but once you have it, man, it's going to be hard to get rid of them, mm-hmm. right? They are typically pretty intuitive and make excellent troubleshooters. And they lean towards worst case scenarios. And they often are kind of experienced as pessimists. And to that, they would reply, I am not a pessimist. I am a realist, right?
Oh, right. Yes.
So that's kind of their MO. They're constantly making plans for what could go wrong. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes experience high levels of anxiety because this kind of innate self-doubt that they experience with making decisions.
Yeah.
So that's type six. Type seven, finally, the enthusiast. Sevens know how to have fun. I mean, they are just like the bubbles of the Enneagram. They're just so magnetic, really. They're usually found doing something really spontaneous and exciting or interesting. They're incredible entrepreneurs and brilliant thinkers, very fast thinkers.
Yeah.
Always looking for the next adventure, really exuberant and optimistic, and can really kind of be collectors of friends with this magnetic kind of optimism. And their mechanism to avoid is to avoid pain, right? And avoid those darker emotions that come along with life. So in an effort to numb or avoid pain, sevens can sometimes cause hurt by ignoring or sidestepping or being oblivious to people's feelings because they're just too dark and too heavy and it's too scary to go there. So in the quest for this upbeat kind of adventurous life, they can be often non-committal and self-serving. Mm-hmm. But they're fabulous and we love type sevens. They're so much fun. And are brilliant people in so many ways. Their core belief is that you must keep life open and up to get your needs fulfilled and to have a good life. So
well, you can
imagine how that plays out if you don't do work as a seven, right?
Well, that's it. Okay. So I was listening to that thinking, oh, like that sounds terrible to me because that contradicts everything internally that I need for connection and like what I look to in life, like what I'm striving for in life, like a seven. Totally. Seems like it would be a very difficult personality for me to yes. feel safe with, if that makes yes. sense.
Oh, I think that's so well said. Yes.
Okay. I kind of want to talk a little bit more about that in just a second, but how do you, I'm curious how you use the Enneagram now that we know the different types. And again, there's so much more to the Enneagram because you have subtypes, you have, what is the other thing called where it's like the kind of, it's like sexual, social.
Yeah, so those are the subtypes. So
that's a subtype. But then, okay, you can have wings, maybe. Is that the other piece?
Love types, lines, arrows, growth paths, all growth. Of that.
Yeah. So there's so much more to learn. So you guys, if you are interested in this, this is another resource that Katie can maybe help you with, you know, moving forward and diving into the Enneagram. But I want to know how you use the Enneagram to help people heal trauma. I found that so fascinating.
Yeah. Well, basically, our traumas kind of force us into these ways of being and ways of protecting ourselves that are often require us to kind of split or dissociate, right? Yeah. Because, you know, when we are violated we're vulnerable. And so you better believe that after trauma, you know, we kind of go into this fight or flight mode in order to self-protect, right? Whether that's sexual trauma, whether that's, you know, either it's big T trauma or little T trauma. It could be right. subtle and it could be very overt. Or it could be very, you know, obvious trauma. But the Enneagram, a big word in the Enneagram community is integration, right? Mm-hmm. So the Enneagram really, the path of healing as prescribed, I believe, by the Enneagram is to reconnect to that true self, that vulnerable self, the essential self, right? That we were born into the world with. You know, trauma forces us to split mm-hmm. from that mm-hmm. vulnerable self mm-hmm. and self-protect, right? And so part of the work I do with people who have experienced a lot of trauma is to reintroduce those parts that were too painful. They had to leave behind. They were violated. And so what we do using the Enneagram is we unearth the story of their personality that they've been living out of, how they had to survive using their personality. And we begin to write a new narrative.
Yeah.
And we begin to reintegrate. You've heard of, you know, inner child work or yeah. shadow work. That's yeah. basically what we do using the Enneagram. The Enneagram just gives us a very clear roadmap with which to do that. It's kind of like this scaffolding that we can use, this structure that we can use to begin to rewrite our story mm-hmm. that's true. It's going from unreality to reality, which I believe is the spiritual journey. So the Enneagram is this psycho-spiritual tool that we have that not only helps us heal from trauma and reconnect and reintegrate ourselves, but it helps us to write a powerful new narrative that actually fits, yeah. that actually is in alignment with the truth of who we are.
Yeah.
So it's like this, it's this homecoming. It's this beautiful homecoming. I believe that the Enneagram allows us to make.
Yeah.
And it's all about coming home to the truth of who we are and leaving behind the parts of our story that don't work for us anymore.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting. I mean, I just love when the universe creates these things that happen, but I have heard maybe 4 or 5 times in the last week and a half that our biggest journey is always, and our biggest relationship is always the relationship with ourselves, right? And so any sort of therapy that I've done or any sort of work that I'm still continuing to look into, it always goes back to that. And in this, I'm hearing that again, that it's just understanding yourself enough to go, how do I heal that part? And then how do I use the parts of myself that are wonderful, that are my gifts, that are my strengths, and create a life that is fulfilling and to where I'm serving and giving back to the universe what I came here to do.
Yes. Oh, that is so powerful. That's it. That's, yeah. That's the work. That's, yeah. You just said it so beautifully.
Thank you.
And it is that oftentimes it's that journey, you know, inward, you know, that journey from this, you know, often exhausting headspace to the heart.
Yeah.
To soften into that space and to hold space for those parts of us that we had to abandon along the way because of our trauma, right?
Yeah. That's a big word. So I know anytime the Enneagram comes up amongst my friends or just in conversation, the first question people ask is, are there certain types that work better than others in relationship? And what I've studied is that it doesn't matter the number, but it's about someone wanting to understand. It's like the level of health maybe, or the level of growth that a person is willing to accept within their number. And that's where the compatibility, like you could find it with any number.
Right.
There's some articles that I will say do seem to hint at certain numbers being more, they just work better or they work easier. Right. What would you say to that?
You know, I think it's both and, honestly.
Okay.
I think it's both and, like most things in life. I think the either or game is just too binary. I think that there are certain types that naturally really, really complement.
Okay.
But I also believe that any type, we can make any type work with another type if, to use that D word, our desire is there and yeah. we're willing to do the work, right?
Yeah.
So I believe that, sure, I think certain types really, there's a very prevalent four and nine.
Yeah. Like I thought that was interesting when you said your husband's a nine.
Yeah. I have so many people that I've talked to or listened to in this world that is a pretty dynamic duo for some reason, but I think it does work.
I can see that.
But honestly, like a one and a four, if you're doing your work, the thing is, the work is to become less identified by type,
mm-hmm.
to relax those tendencies, to become more open to receive and be a human being rather than a type.
Totally. That makes complete sense to me.
If we're doing the work of the Enneagram, hopefully we'll relax that kind of arthritic grip that personality has on us. We'll start to relax that so that we can honestly, you know, our ego is not driving the ship anymore. So now we can show up as our true selves and hopefully we can connect with any type.
Well, right. Because I don't actually like, I think I said this a little bit earlier, but like, you know, there's a lot of people who go, oh, like, I don't want to be that number. But for me, it's been about a journey of acceptance again. And then, you know, finding the benefits and then in understanding my weaknesses as a certain, you know, type, but it, just accepting them as like a tiny piece and kind of going, oh, yeah, I am doing that again. For me, with in my relationships, for instance, it's like so much easier if someone else understands their type and my type, because they can understand like the driving forces behind why it's so important to me to do certain things, or I can do the same for them. Why something that I think is silly and irrelevant is just so important, you know,
yeah.
And just identifying those things.
Yes. Well, I think we have so much more compassion for ourselves and for other people when we understand what's motivating their behavior.
Yes. Even the fear piece, like when you said that about an eight, I had never heard that for some reason. And I get so frustrated with eights in my life, but that actually just made me go, oh, they're driven by that fear, yeah. Thus making so many behaviors that I've experienced make complete sense.
Totally.
Yeah.
No, you're spot on.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about this, the practice. It's a Enneagram-based self-development toolkit that you've created, and I wanted to talk about, one, what you can offer to people and why you think this would be helpful.
Yeah, so throughout the 12-year course of being a therapist in private practice, I've heard the same kind of broken record over and over and over again, which is, I need tools, right?
Yeah.
I need tools for therapy to use outside of therapy. You know, it's like, we wouldn't expect to go to the gym twice a month and see like real results. You know, we have to change some things in our daily life to align with kind of this work that we're doing in the gym with the trainer. And same is true with our emotional fitness, really.
Yeah.
We have to, I believe, like the work I do with clients is to create rhythms in their daily lives that that really support their desired outcomes that they want to experience in life, right? So the practice is based on the premise that whatever we practice, we improve. Mm-hmm. And so, like you said, it's like this, it's a monthly membership, and it's a specialized toolkit that's designed to take the guesswork out of self-care for people. So it combines three core practices: meditation, journaling, and self-compassion. And it also teaches the Enneagram in a way that helps us apply the Enneagram in our daily life. So the practice, when you join the practice, what's so powerful is that you get a plan for your self-care, right? You get tools that you can use outside the therapy office, and you get accountability and support through becoming a member of this program. So that is the reason I feel like we don't thrive the way we want to in life is we don't have the accountability. We don't have the structures set up in our life to achieve the goals that we long to see in our life. So that's why I created the practice, because I just, after 12 years of hearing the same thing, I'm like, okay, I want to create a plan for anyone and everyone who really desires to do the deeper inner work of the Enneagram and really practice self-care so that they can thrive and become the best versions of who they are, their true authentic selves.
And this is just a subscription-based program that people can do online. Do you have daily things, or is it weekly?
It's daily. So every week you get basically a new module, and you get new meditations, new journal prompts, one for every day of the week, a self-compassion practice that you bake into your schedule at some point during the week. And it comes with a little Enneagram teaching. Every month we have experts in the field of the Enneagram and wellness that kind of, teach us, give us like a front row seat to their expertise as it pertains to the Enneagram and just the larger healing arts community. And so there's two live streaming support sessions that you can hop on and get some accountability and encouragement, you know, wherever you're feeling stuck. So it's kind of this ever-changing design that you grow with from week to week.
So I'm assuming the journal prompts, the meditations, they're type specific, like you register as your type. Okay. Amazing. Yes. That sounds amazing.
It's really been great. We've gotten a great response. I'm so grateful. It's been so fun.
Yeah. Where can people find this?
So you can go to my website, katiegustafson.co, and there is a banner front and center to join the practice. And you can also go to my Instagram page, my Instagram feed at katiegustafson.co. And there's a link in the bio that you can join the practice as well.
I'm going to put both the link to the website and your Instagram in the description so people know how to spell Gustafson.
You got it.
I'm getting it. We're getting there.
The funny thing is my husband's last name is Hill.
Well, I mean, that would be a lot easier, Katie.
I know it would be so much easier, but I used to hate it, but now I kind of can't let it go.
Yeah. I mean, I will never forget it. I will tell you that. Well, thank you so much for being here. I mean, I feel like I could go so much deeper, so we might have to have you back on to answer some more questions about the Enneagram. I love this work and I love what you're doing. You guys go check out Katie at Katie Gustafson on Instagram. And then I'll put all the links to her bio. I mean, I'm sorry, all the links to her website in the bio, so you can check out the practice and dive deeper into the Enneagram if you're more interested.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you again for being here, Katie.
Thank you, Kelly. It's been so fun.
And thank you guys for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Velvet's Edge podcast with Kelly Henderson, where we believe everyone has a little velvet and a little edge. Subscribe for more conversations on life, style, beauty, and relationships. Search Velvet's Edge wherever you get your podcasts.